Okay, I'm John Beck, and I co-direct with my colleague Kurt Dewhurst, who's out of town, Our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives. And let me just hand out some coming attractions. Next week, Frank Bartike is going to be here. Frank wrote a recent book on called Trampling Out the Vintage, The Rise and Fall of the United Farm Workers. He's going to be talking from that research next week. He's here also for the North American Labor History Conference that's going to be going on at Wayne State next Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. So we worked out with Wayne State in terms of sharing Frank's time here in Michigan. So please do take those. We have two brown bags coming up in November. Let me just say that both of them will be wonderful, but Candace Taylor, if you see no one else this year in this series, you have to see Candace Taylor talking about the labor of hairdressing. She's a folklorist, currently an Archie Green fellow at the Smithsonian and Library of Congress. So I think it's wonderful. For those in-town people, let me just announce that I'll just hand this around. I only have one copy, but we're doing a different series called Sharper Focus, Wider Lens, which are transdisciplinary discussions of large topics. On Monday, there's a four faculty panel talking about Detroit, the past, present, and future of the city. And it's going to be really, I think, very, very cool, because we have Roddy Whitaker from Jazz Studies, Zena Coatville from the School of Planning, Design, and Construction, Carl Taylor, who's one of our local resident experts on gangs in Detroit, and then Joe Darden talking about his recent book from about the 1967 riots forward. And Joe's rather controversial, because he's really telling people in the city of Detroit that they should leave the city. That is, that he is basically saying that if you want to do something for yourselves as families or whatever, you have to leave Detroit, because people are not going to make Detroit better. And that you have to maximize at the individual level. Joe's kind of an interesting conservative in that fashion, so it'll be wild to watch. But do come out. That's 7 o'clock Monday night at the Union. And then let me take a walk on the wild side back to where the sign-in sheets are and just hand those around. So do sign in. We love to know that you're here. Good. Great. Thanks, Jim. And now let me turn to the main attraction. I was so happy that we were able to get Kathleen Newman to come to Michigan State University for this talk. Kathleen is currently an associate professor in the English department at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. And we're very lucky that she brought her colleague from the University of Pittsburgh, Sarah Apple, along with her. So we're very, very happy to have Sarah in the audience today. Kathleen's work, really looks, current work, looks at the kind of fiction through film and the actuality of what strikes look like in the 1950s. And boy, do we have bells today, I think. I think they decided they didn't really want to hear about strikes in the 1950s in the central administration, so they put the... Yeah, really. So Kathleen has a wonderful presentation for us today. We're going to be looking at a film clip later on. Just cue me and I'll see if I can actually do the technology for you from on the waterfront. And please help me in welcoming Kathleen Newman from the Department of English at Carnegie Mellon University to Our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives.
Yeah. Probably don't need a microphone, but... thank you so much for having me today. I'm thrilled that Sarah was willing to be my wing woman on the drive up here. We're trying to create something in Pittsburgh similar to what you've built here in East Lansing. We're calling it the Pittsburgh Collaborative for Working Class Studies, and we're grateful for your hospitality, and we're inspired by the intellectual and political community that you've created. I became interested in labor and labor history while working to create a TA union at Yale in the 1990s. We were called GSO, the Graduate Employee Student Organization. GSO was never granted union recognition. It still isn't. But I learned how to organize, and I cut my teeth fighting one of the most vicious anti-union employers in the Ivy League. My first book was based on my dissertation. It's called Radioactive, Advertising and Consumer Activism. And it's really about the dialectic between advertising and activism. I argued that radio advertising created, without meaning to, the modern-day consumer movement. I did have one chapter that dealt with class, which was on a conservative radio commentator named Boak Carter. He was sponsored by Philco Radio. So Philco radio workers organized a boycott of their own product. This was a Philco ad from the 30s. And in a letter they sent to Boak Carter, they said, "We hope that you will neither have to stoop, squat, nor squint to see the logic of this letter," sort of playing on Philco's own ads. And they were partially successful with getting Boak Carter run off the air, similar to campaigns that people have today against Rush Limbaugh. Over the last 10 years, my work has been shaped by my growing involvement in the Working Class Studies Association, as well as by writing regularly for the blog Working Class Perspectives. I've become increasingly interested in the problems of class and representation. There's a consensus among a lot of scholars in this area that working people have been lampooned, degraded, and condescended to by the mass media over the last century. The most significant work that makes this argument is Pepe Lestina's documentary Class Dismissed, where he argues that when working men and women appear on our TV screens, especially, they appear to us as buffoons, fat bus drivers like Ralph Cramden, dim-witted sewer workers like Ed Norton, the imbecilic nuclear plant worker Homer Simpson, or the bigoted dock worker Archie Bunker. On the big screen, we've had a few working class heroes. Of course, we have Norma Rae, Karen Silkwood, and Aaron Brockovich. But these heroic worker figures are rare. And as Barbara Ehrenreich has argued, the American working class is essentially a silenced majority, invisible in news reports, mass market magazines, films, and television programs. Roseanne Barr, who starred in one of the most popular working class sitcoms in TV history, has said, "Hollywood hates labor and hates shows about labor more than any other thing." Lestina, Ehrenreich, and Barr are mostly right, but in their critiques of how mass culture has represented workers, they have generalized their condemnation to the point where we have lost the ability to see any other story, especially about the 1950s. Other than after 1948, the most radical members lost their radical edge, sacrificed their radical culture, and eventually lost their ability to lead the American left. In researching striking images, I have found a forgotten 1950s, a 1950s that is both darker, grittier, and bleaker than the Leave It to Beaver stereotypes that we have of the era, but also a 1950s that is more hopeful about the future for working people than we remember. So what I'm hoping to gain by remembering these striking images is a sense of how working people have represented themselves and how they have appeared to themselves and others, as well as how the working class has used media strategically to shape the larger political and cultural world in which it operates. How workers appeared to themselves and others is a story that will, I hope, give us new powers of vision as we look to the future of working people in an increasingly global and digitalized world. So my talk will end today with a focus on the film On the Waterfront, but I'd like to give you a quick sense of the project as a whole. These are the four things I'm hoping to show. How real-life labor struggles were used as the basis for many 1950s films and television shows. How the working class or left political commitments of the producers of these shows influenced their work. How working class audiences responded to these films. And how working class people used their own films and television programs at times to tell their own stories. I'm hoping to resurrect or excavate some cultural documents that have been entirely forgotten. I start with a film that I lay odds most of you have never heard of, The Whistle at Eaton Falls, a black and white melodrama about a struggling New England coastal town and a wildcat strike in a plastics factory. Came out in 1951. It was Ernest Borgnine's first feature film and figured into Lloyd Bridges' early career as well. The film was made by an eccentric Cold War conservative, Louis de Rochemont, And because of his bizarre ambitions, he wanted to make a film that would appeal to both business leaders and to union members. In trying to please both labor and capital, he failed to please anyone, and the film was a flop. But not before de Rochemont got important philanthropists and corporate leaders and labor leaders to screen the film and weigh in with their reviews. This was the press book created for the film, and here's the back of the press book, which showed labor leaders right next to business leaders. The only time, I'm going to guess, that this ever happened in a Hollywood press book. One labor historian has argued that for all of its flaws, Whistle at Eaton Falls had one of the most realistic depictions of a union meeting ever put on a Hollywood screen. This film is still not available. You can only see it in archives, and if anybody wants to know more about it, I can talk about it later. I'm also bringing back to life Clash by Night, a play written by Clifford Odets when he was the darling of the left cultural establishment, not to mention the nation. This is him on the cover in 1938, with his plays Awake and Sing and Waiting for Lefty, which you might remember Elia Kazan was the star actor in. The 1952 movie of the 1941 play starred Marilyn Monroe as the most adorable cannery worker ever. Barbara Stanwyck starred as a careworn and reluctant housewife who settles down with Paul Douglas, plays a stalwart fisherman. But then Stanwyck falls in love with Robert Ryan, who plays a cynical movie projectionist. The original play I recently discovered was inspired by a newspaper clipping that Odets read in the summer of 1938. The headline read, "Movie Operator Beaten to Death in Duel During Show." And in fact, Odets sets the climax of Clash by Night in a projection booth and allows the lowly fisherman to beat the projectionist, the rival for his wife's love, nearly to death. I was fascinated that a real-life projectionist brawl sparked by a conflict over whose shift it was transformed in Clash by Night into a morality tale about class and infidelity. The ultimate message of Clash by Night is that the moving pictures churned out by Tinseltown compel the working class to dream beyond its station. Working class folks are better off, according to the story, if they kill the movies and make the best of what little they have. A strange message indeed, to be carried by the film that allowed Marilyn Monroe her first star billing. Another forgotten working class film is The Garment Jungle, 1957, about the murder of an ILGWU organizer by a hoodlum hired by the dress factory boss. It starred Lee J. Cobb as the boss and Robert Loggia in his first film as the organizer. Made with the cooperation of the ILGWU in 1956, the film was based on the real-life murder of William Lurier, an ILGWU organizer who was murdered in 1949 and whose murder made 3-inch headlines in both New York and Chicago. Chicago is where he was born. More than 65,000 garment workers thronged the streets of the garment district to attend Lurier's funeral, and the film cuts archival footage from the funeral into the 1957 film. It was directed initially by Robert Adler, who called it the first pro-labor Hollywood film. And indeed, much of it was filmed at ILGWU headquarters. This is a poster in the background, a 30s-era poster. The future of the world lies in the hands of the intelligent and well-informed workers. This is a strike scene from the film. And then this is the ILGWU cooperative village that was also featured in the background of the movie. The ultimate message of The Garment Jungle is that bosses will be more successful financially as well as morally if they treat their workers with respect. The message to union organizers is, it's dangerous, but it's still worth the fight for justice. Alongside these forgotten films, I'm also trying to resurrect some of the decade's most celebrated representations of working class people. Among these are the television drama Marty, which aired in the spring of 1953 and was made into the feature film Marty in 1955, starring Ernest Borgnine as a hapless, lovelorn butcher. Borgnine won the Oscar for Best Actor in 1956 for his performance in the film. Marty is sometimes viewed as an apologia for the lower middle class or the petty bourgeoisie. And indeed, Marty in the movie version, in addition to wanting true love, also wants to open up his own butcher shop. But the moral of the story is about valuing quality of life over money, consumerism, or a house in the suburbs. Marty lives in a rundown house with his mother in the Bronx, and his dream is to get married and live in a slightly nicer apartment in the same neighborhood. Marty dreams, but his dreams are modest, sweet, and quite possibly still out of reach. Marty is hardly a labor union call to arms, but the film was celebrated for offering a sympathetic picture of losers rather than winners. In addition, the studio that produced the film milked the labor angle for all it was worth. They got the Santa Monica Bay District Meat Cutters Union Local 587 to present Borgnine with a gold urn in return for his portrayal of, quote, the meat cutters of America as friendly, humble, and sincere. They also had Borgnine pose as a real-life butcher at the opening of a giant supermarket on the Santa Monica Pier. And this was to campaign for the Oscar. This picture appeared in Life magazine. And what I love about it is the woman who so clearly wants her face to be the feature item that we focus on. Another beloved depiction of working class people in the 1950s is the Sunny musical about a strike in a pajama factory over a demanded raise of 7.5 cents per hour. No film or labor scholar has ever taken this musical seriously. On the other hand, the French critic and filmmaker Jean-Luc Godard did call it the first left-wing operetta. Interestingly, neither the Broadway musical nor the film was a touchstone for the ILGWU, in part because they had singing and dancing covered in their many union-backed choruses and talent shows. But the musical did become a lightning rod for activism among theater professionals. Songs from the Pajama Game were sung at a midnight strike vote of actors and singers not long after the musical opened on Broadway. So here's a picture of the musical cast, and on the far your right there is Stanley Prager, who was blacklisted. So he was in the stage version, but not the film version. Once the film was underway, a group of chorus members threatened Jack Warner, the head of the studio that made the film, with a strike if their members weren't paid more for their work. So ironically, perhaps, affiliation with the Pajama Game seemed to raise worker consciousness among the musical's performers. One of the most quoted songs from the musical by labor unions is the rousing march demanding a raise of 7.5 cents. Here's the scene from the movie. You might remember the song. 7.5 cents doesn't buy a hell of a lot. 7.5 cents doesn't mean a thing. But give it to me every hour, 40 hours every week, and that's enough for me to be living like a king. So there's Doris Day singing that song, and the last line is, I'll have myself a buying spree, I'll buy a pajama factory, then I could end up having old man Hassler work for me. So the song ends with a humorous but literal suggestion that the workers come to own the means of production. And finally, there is The Honeymooners, the beloved television comedy that started as a simple sketch routine about a hapless bus driver and his nagging wife on the Jackie Gleason show in the early 1950s, and which became a standalone sitcom in 1956. Though it suffered relatively low ratings during the production of what are called the classic 39 episodes, the sitcom eventually became so popular, such an emblem of working class rage and lowbrow humor, that in the last 60 years, The Honeymooners has never been off the air. What we don't remember, however, is that the Transit Workers Union, the union that Ralph Cramden would have belonged to if he'd been a real person, was frequently on strike nearly every 6 months during the 1950s, threatened or actual. In addition, the TWU had its own local television program during the era. that ran for 16 years called the TW on TV. And in one of the great moments in which worlds collided, in 1956, when Jackie Gleason was subbing for the regular host of People to People, Gleason was set up to interview one of the leaders of the Transit Workers Union. And the union chief scolded Gleason for not having Ralph Cramden wear a TWU button on his bus driver's uniform on the show. Ironically, perhaps the most successful production of the 1950s that was most pointedly about the plight of workers on the waterfront has been widely dismissed by film and labor historians over the last half century. But it was certainly embraced by working class people when it debuted on July 28, 1954, when the film surprised nearly everyone with its popularity. So there's the line outside Astor Theater, and some of the people who consulted on the film joked that if the Waterfront Crime Commission just rounded up the first 200 people in line to see on the waterfront, that they would have eliminated all mob activity on the docks. Here's a poster for it outside the Woods Theater in Chicago. The film cost about $900,000 to make and was filmed in 36 days in Hoboken, New Jersey. Though Fox studio head Daryl Zanuck famously turned down the film with the line, "Who's going to give a shit about a lot of sweaty longshoremen?" Lots of people apparently did. On the Waterfront made nearly $10 million at the box office. The film was nominated for 12 Academy Awards and it won 8, including the award for Best Picture, Best Director, Best Story, Best Actor, Best Supporting Actress, Best Black and White Cinematography. Today, On the Waterfront is considered the 8th best American film of all time by the American Film Institute. In the academic world, On the Waterfront is most often viewed as the work of a snitch, a Cold War coward, Elia Kazan, who ratted on his communist comrades. If you open up one of more than 3,000 college film textbooks or academic articles on the subject, the meaning of On the Waterfront is frequently reduced to Elia Kazan's cagey defense of the seemingly indefensible, a stool pigeon who ratted on his friends. In his autobiography, which came out in 83, Kazan admitted as much. "When critics say that I put my story and my feelings on the screen to justify my informing, they are right." But today I want to argue that this is not the only or even the most interesting way of seeing the film. I argue that the original idea for the story, the characters, the themes, the plot lines, the shooting location, and the dominant setting of On the Waterfront all had their origins in an authentic working class social formation. I will show how a Catholic priest devoted to the problem of longshoremen had a lot to do with exposing the mob-controlled and degraded working conditions of the New York docks in the period through a variety of mass media. I will also show that many of the other artists involved in the film came from or had legitimate connections to the working class that they were trying to represent. And I will try to show that it was the waterfront itself, its abusive working conditions and its foggy, watery aesthetics, and its proximity to the cultural center that was New York, that generated the many newspaper articles, magazine stories, films, and television shows about the waterfront. On the Waterfront emerged as the most commercially successful waterfront story and has become the most iconic, but it was only one story among dozens, if not hundreds, that were produced about waterfront conditions in the 1950s. In 1945, a 34-year-old priest named John M. Corridon was assigned to the Xavier Labor School on 30th West 16th Street in New York. He'd been born in Harlem in 1911, the oldest son of a New York policeman who was killed when Corridon was 10. He grew up in a neighborhood where he claims you either became a gangster or a priest. After weathering the stock market crash with a job in the sales division of National City Company, Corridon read The Power and the Secret of the Jesuits and applied to be one and was accepted. He started his priesthood training in 1931. The Xavier Labor School, where Corydon started work, had been founded in the 30s, and its mission was to combat communism by explaining Catholic social principles to working men. Interestingly, however, the labor classes of priests like Corydon showed how Christian principles could be applied to labor management problems. And conversely, the school tried to hold employers to the Christian principles they espoused. Today we know about Father Corydon in large part because the passionate American Studies professor Jim Fisher, who's written a book that links the Father Corydon and On the Waterfront with the vibrant and violent Irish community that lived, worked, and prayed and was preyed upon the docks of New York City. Thanks to Professor Fisher's treasure map, I have used some of the same sources. And in his seminal book, On the Irish Waterfront, you can find some of the same stories I'm telling today. When Father Corydon started recruiting longshoremen to his labor classes in the Chelsea area, he was shocked by the hiring practice called the shape-up, in which hundreds of men would wait for a very small number of jobs. So this is a picture of a shape-up from 1915. It basically remained unchanged up through the middle of the 1950s. Large groups of men would gather on the docks, and a small percentage of those men were chosen to work that day, much like you might see migrant workers standing outside of Home Depot today. And it's also, I think, where the expression shape up or ship out comes from. So Corydon estimated that the New York area docks could employ roughly 17,000 workers per year, but that twice as many as that clamored for work every day. Corydon also found that the shape-up system kept wages low. In a television debate on WPIX, Corydon showed that 88% of longshoremen made about $3,500 a year and that 56% made less than $2,500 a year. And a good working class salary, like in the steel mills, could be as much as $5,000 a year in this period. Corydon said that longshoremen live in tenements, will not be accepted into private housing, and that they cannot borrow from a bank or from personal finance companies because their earnings are considered too unstable and too low. He explained that the mob controlled the docks and that the docks were unsafe, impoverishing, and corrupt. And the root of the problem, Corydon argued, was American materialism and greed. In 1948, dock workers began to come to Corydon for advice in a wildcat strike they were planning, a strike that was a direct challenge to Joseph P. Ryan, leader of the union and accused of colluding with the mob. In the midst of a wildcat strike, the unsolved shooting death of a boss stevedore named Tom Collentine drew the attention of a stocky, hard-digging reporter named Malcolm Mike Johnson, a journalist for the New York Sun. Johnson wrote 24 stories for the Sun, which ran under the title Crime on the Waterfront. In these exposés, he claimed that an alliance between the International Longshoremen's Union and the mob led to a pilfering of an estimated $50 million per year from the cargoes. Union boss Ryan countered that Johnson was a communist, but the charge did not hold. As the stories started to appear in November of 1948, Johnson and his family began to receive death threats over the telephone and finally moved and changed their phone number. In addition to death threats, dozens of letters praising Johnson's article began to come into the office of the New York Sun, and one of them was from Father Corydon. The city editor handed Corydon's letter to Johnson and said, "You better go around and see this man." Johnson would later describe Corydon as an earthy, plain-spoken, prematurely bald man who was single-handedly leading a fight against what well may be the toughest gang in America. Writing a few years after his articles were published, Johnson conceded that Corydon had shaped his view of the waterfront situation, and he described himself as one of the waterfront priest's recruits. Corydon had decided that the only way to change the situation was on the docks, was to get the attention of the local and national press. The famed kind of former socialist Daniel Bell did a series on the docks. Arthur Miller, many of you probably know, worked on an earlier waterfront script with Elia Kazan long before On the Waterfront. Explaining his public strategy, Corydon wrote, I realized a long time ago there was only one hope, and that was publicity. Only by awaking the public and their officials could anything be done about the waterfront. In 1949, Johnson won a Pulitzer Prize for his series, and the series also prompted the televised hearings the Waterfront Crime Commission, led by Senator Estes Kefauver. The expulsion of the ILA, the union from the AFL-CIO, and the creation of the New York-New Jersey Waterfront Commission. So in 1949, a small film company, Monticello, was incorporated for the sole purpose of turning Malcolm Johnson's Crime on the Waterfront series into a film. Monticello had ties to Columbia Pictures and was somehow able to persuade Bud Schulberg to write the screenplay. Schulberg had sworn off Hollywood forever and lived on a small farm in eastern PA, but he was intrigued by what Johnson had written, and he soon was introduced to Father Corydon, which Schulberg described as a rangy, fast-talking, chain-smoking West Side product who talked the darndest language I have ever heard, combining the gritty vocabulary of the longshoreman with mob talk, the statistical findings of a trained economist, and the teachings of Christ. Schulberg, like Johnson, became entranced by the waterfront priest. In 1951, he wrote a letter to Corydon, which he tried to sound upbeat about the film project. He said, "I've never really had an opportunity to tell you what a deep impression you made on me by your mission and your devotion to it. I am hopeful that our waterfront film will get into production this fall." But Schulberg was wrong. The fledgling movie company that owned the rights to Johnson's stories folded, and Schulberg's screenplay, which had several names, including The Bottom of the River and The Stone on the Bottom of the River Hudson, was left for dead. So my point in telling this part of the story is to argue that On the Waterfront was Bud Schulberg's brainchild long before it was Kazan's. In addition, the idea for the film was inspired by the story of the docks themselves, as reported by Malcolm Johnson. I do not believe that Bud Schulberg's decision to testify as a friendly witness before the House on Un-American Activities Committee inspired the choices he made in early drafts of On the Waterfront. If anything, it is possible that the work he did on the waterfront film inspired his decision to testify, which he did in May of 1951. In his testimony, he talked about being harangued by Communist Party higher-ups, John Howard Lawson and V.G.A. Jerome. Specifically, they asked him to change his novel, What Makes Sammy Run, and to submit an outline of the novel to the party before he finished writing it. "When I came away," he said, "I felt maybe almost for the first time that this was to me the real face of the party." After Elia Kazan testified about a year later in 1952 and then rubbed salt in the wounds of his former comrades by taking out a full-page New York Times ad trumpeting what he had done, Schulberg reached out to Kazan, writing him a letter of sympathy. Kazan got in touch with Schulberg and suggested they work together. They had never previously met. Kazan proposed that they work together on an idea he had for a Western vigilante justice-type film that would be set in the East. He said, "Let's make an Eastern." The subject Kazan was interested in was the Trenton Six, six African-American youth who'd been accused of killing a shopkeeper. But Schulberg insisted that they work on the screenplay he already had, based on the articles that Malcolm Johnson had written for the New York Sun. Kazan was inspired by Schulberg's passion for what he'd learned on the docks, and he wrote about it in his autobiography. He said, "I would always remember that this was the way to prepare a screenplay, not to observe at arm's length and scribble notes, but to make yourself one of the people in whom you're interested in." Bud had made himself more than a writer engaged to prepare a screenplay. He'd made himself a champion of humanity on that strip of shore. So in one of the most radical and dramatic moments of On the Waterfront is the scene where a dock worker who's about to testify against the mob is killed. And so this is my film clip. This is a famous speech that Carl Malden, as the waterfront priest, gives in the hold. K.O. Dugan has just been killed by, and there's irony here, a shipment of Irish whiskey.
He don't need a doctor, he needs a priest.
I came down here to keep a promise. I gave K.O. my word that if he stood up to the mob, I'd stand up with him. All the way. And now K.O. Dugan is dead. He was one of those fellas who had the gift of standing up, but this time they fixed him. Oh, they fixed him for good this time. Unless it was an accident, like Big Mac says. Some people think the crucifixion only took place on Calvary. They better wise up. Taking Joey Doyle's life to stop him from testifying is a crucifixion. And dropping a sling on K.O. Dugan because he was ready to spill his guts tomorrow, that's a crucifixion. And every time the mob puts the crusher on a good man, tries to stop him from doing his duty as a citizen, it's a crucifixion. And anybody who sits around and lets it happen, keeps silent about something he knows has happened, shares the guilt of it just as much as the Roman soldier who pierced the flesh of our Lord to see if he's dead.
Go back to your church, Father!
Boys, this is my church! And if you don't think Christ is down here on the waterfront, you've got another guest coming.
Get off the dock, Father!
Tell you, don't do that.
Who said you on, boy?
Let him finish.
Every morning, when the hiring boss blows his whistle, Jesus stands alongside you in the shape-up. He sees why some of you get picked and some of you get passed over. He sees the family men worrying about getting their rent and getting food in the house for the wife and the kids. He sees you selling your souls to the mob for a day's pay.
The next bum that throws something deals with me. I don't care if he's twice my size.
Now, what does Christ think of the easy money boys who do none of the work and take all of the gravy? And how does he feel about the fellas who wear $150 suits and diamond rings on your union dues and your kickback money? And how does he, who spoke up without fear against every evil, feel about your silence?
Tell him about that!
Just watch this. You see that?
You want to know what's wrong with our waterfront? It's the love of a lousy buck. It's making love of a buck, the cushy job, more important than the love of man. It's forgetting that every fella down here is your brother in Christ. But remember, Christ is always with you. Christ is in the shape up, he's in the hatch, he's in the union, he's kneeling right here beside Dugan. And he's staying with all of you. If you do it to the least of mine, you do it to me.
Okay.
What they did to Joey and what they did to Dugan, they're doing to you.
Okay, so back to the... I know, it's one of the... So, this speech is based almost verbatim on this speech that John Corydon gave frequently on the docks. You know what's wrong with the waterfront? It's the love of a buck. Christ also said, if you do it to the least of mine, you do it to me. Christ is in the shape-up. He stands in the shape-up knowing that all won't get work, and maybe he won't. What does Christ think of the man who picks up a longshoreman's brass check and takes 20% interest at the end of the week? Christ goes to a union meeting and sees a few with $150 suits and diamond rings on their fingers. Sorry for the typos there. It's not Chris in the shape-up. You can see how much the real-life waterfront priest shaped the way this film was made. There were two crucial moments when Corydon and his followers might have won on the docks. One was in 1951 when a faction of the longshoremen rejected a union-negotiated contract and went on a wildcat strike. Father Corydon supported their effort, and the strike shut down ports in New York and New Jersey for 25 days. To refute a claim by the mob, dominated union that strikers were communists, Father Corden held a public prayer service with the strikers. He also successfully pressured Governor Dewey to address the issue of mob control on the docks. The second chance came during a union election in which the AFL-backed union challenged Joseph P. Ryan and the mob-corrupted ILA in 1953, during the time that On the Waterfront was being filmed in Hoboken. The AFL's new union, called the International Brotherhood of Longshoremen, or IBL, had many leaders drawn from the men who consulted with Schulberg and Kazan on their film, and whom Father Corden had recruited. The election took place in May of 1954, 2 months before the debut of the film. Schulberg and Corden holed up in Brooklyn with a group of waterfront workers as the votes were being counted. Their side lost, but there was reports of widespread voter corruption and intimidation. In June, Corden's side was still hopeful, as a dock worker named Tony Buell explained in a letter to Kazan. He said that there were 1,800 challenged votes. There was a difference of about 2,000 votes. And that the AFL had fired all of them, knocked them off the payroll. And then he says, I hope that the movie does really well. Ultimately, Corden's side lost, though by 1957, the hiring process known as the shape-up was banned from the docks. And as many of the letters between Kazan and Schulberg and the workers suggest, if On the Waterfront had come out before the vote in May, the election very likely could have gone Father Corden's way. The vast majority of scholarly books and articles about this film dismiss its working class setting and the real life workers who inspired the story on which the movie was based. Most who write about the movie agree more or less with Howard Lawson, the Communist Party member and blacklisted screenwriter, who published a review of the film in December of 1954, calling it an obnoxious fake, a personal story that pretended to be about social justice for real workers but wasn't. Lawson charged that the film had the veneer of neorealism but not the substance, which would have been genuine concern for unions and working class people. But Father Corden, Malcolm Johnson, Bud Schulberg, Arthur Miller some years before, and even Elia Kazan, so many of the artists, journalists, and priests that came near the waterfront situation were moved by the situation on the docks and tried to do something to change it. Howard Lawson argued that the film created the fiction that the working class lived in a climate of terror and brutality. But it is certainly clear that the working class on the docks did live in a climate of terror and brutality. This last picture is of Kazan there, the third to the right with the workers that inspired the story. So I hope today I've given you a glimpse of some of the real workers behind the making of the film, and that you'll come away with a sharper memory of some of the striking images from the decade. Thanks. I think the show offers a critique of 50s consumer culture. Every episode, Ralph wants to improve. They want to get a new TV, they want an appliance, and at the end of every episode, that scheme has been foiled. And it's about never achieving the American dream. but still having love. I mean, somewhat disingenuously squished into that last embrace. There's an episode in which there's a rent strike. There's several episodes that involve, you know, Ralph having to be on strike with his union. Alice's frequent comments to him are about his weight, and that's sort of partly where I'm making a consumption argument. He says, it'll be the biggest thing I ever got into, and she says, the biggest thing you ever got into was your pants. I think it's a critique of consumerism.
What you say really, really resonates, and I'm more elaborate. The question is, to be obvious about your presentation in this last section on the waterfront, why does such a powerful film get now almost 50 years of reviews that really go to dismissal from, let's say, academics and the type of critics you outline. To me, that's a really big question because the film has never lost
its power.
Its power.
Yeah.
And its place, you know, in American culture, in the hearts of a lot of people.
Yeah. I think that's right. I mean, I think a lot of academics are progressives who are still unforgiving of both Kazan and Schulberg's decision to testify. Lee J. Cobb testified. Clifford Odets was a friendly witness. I mean, almost every cultural producer I'm talking about in this book is considered a traitor to the American left by progressive film historians. And I'm not asking that we ignore that. I'm asking that we consider that in conjunction with Cold War liberalism looks pretty good today. Eisenhower platform, 1956. Rachel Maddow says this. She says, I'm a liberal, which means I'm in complete agreement with the 1956 Republican platform. So I am trying to excavate Cold War liberalism as a positive cultural force that's been dismissed by progressive film and labor historians because those unions purged communists, they fired people, they hurt people, people lost their jobs, people committed suicide. I mean, it was a horrible time for the American left. But I'm sort of looking at what's in the ash pile that's just been forgotten.
Yeah, some of your presentation brought back memories of our advisor, Michael Bates.
Of course. I'm writing a sequel to The Cultural Front. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of the things I want to do is sort of figure out what the breadcrumb trail is to when was it that On the Waterfront became popularly accepted as being about informing, because it wasn't initially. But there were two reviews that were really important. One is the Howard Lawson review and a little broadside called the Hollywood Review. The other is Lindsay Anderson, and I'm sure you've all heard, this is the final scene on, it's called the final scene on the Waterfront. And he says the scene is fascist, that the cowed workers who are cattle-like and have no agency, once Marlon Brando beats the crap out of Johnny Friendly, he emerges as the new figurehead. And that it's only through violence that this new leader can emerge. So Lindsay Anderson is a young British communist who's a filmmaker and who also is a film critic. When I gave this talk at CMU in 2007, one of my colleagues, very close friend, said, I don't buy your argument because Lindsay Anderson in 1955 was right. This last scene is fascist. So I've spent a lot of time watching this last scene. It's a very strange scene because Terry Molloy says, I'm going to go down to the dock and get my rights. Well, he's never really talked about rights the whole movie. Well, what is his right? His right is to a job. And he goes to the shape-up. They need him to work, and they pass him over because he's just snitched. So he gets in a fight with Johnny Friendly. He's winning the fight. The goons come in. They beat him up. He can barely stand. And the waterfront priest says, let him go get his job. And so he kind of stumbles up, and everybody watches as he walks up the docks. And the priest says, don't help him. So Schulberg was obsessed with boxing. Every letter between Schulberg and Kazan is about boxing. It ends with Schulberg saying, oh, I just went to this amazing fight. So this last scene is actually a boxing scene. The fighter has to get up before 10 seconds are counted in order not to be considered knocked out. So I think the ending makes a lot more sense if you think about it in terms of Schulberg's interest in boxing. And that ultimately, all he's fighting for in this moment is the right to work, which isn't terribly progressive, but in the context of the film, you know, he has made the choice to become sort of the rear guard, the leader of the workers who are fighting against the mob. So I don't read this final scene as fascist, but that reading is so powerful that it stands today as the ultimate reading of this film.
Let me play with you on like one notion, that a major shift that we see in this time frame, and, I mean, you know, invoking Marty, invoking the Honeymooners or everything else, Deb's always said, I don't want to rise out of the working class, I want to rise with the working class. Yeah. So, interestingly enough, the on the waterfront, you actually have a merging of kind of feelings about specific totalitarian movements. That is, that the mob is a totalitarian movement. There are others who believe that the party is, but there are others who believe that the U.S. government in opposition to the party is a totalitarian.
Absolutely.
So that there's a lot of agreement in a number of different voices about the whole cult of individuality and getting away from collectives. And I mean, then you get into very strongly, I think, in this whole period moving forward, that kind of that emergent, you know, American individualism and everything else, and leaving behind any form of collectivist notion that we only rise because we all rise, right, or whatever. And I mean, Brando, in effect, you know, coming out as a strong individual, even if he is a potential leader or whatever, it's that distance notion.
I think that's right, but one thing that is true of every text that I look at is that the American dream, as we understand it today, is either not articulated or it's not achieved. So that's I think partly where I see the collectivism in these films. I also think it's pretty hard for Hollywood films to do collectivism. So there's these copious memos from Daryl Zanuck saying you have to make this a personal story. But if you show it against the real backdrop of these working conditions, Americans will get the message. You don't have to hit them over the head with the message. And, you know, Howard Lawson in his critique says this is a Hollywood film. They could not get this made in Hollywood. I mean, it took them almost 5 years to bring it to the screen. Kazan took a pay cut. He offered to go down there with a handheld camera and shoot it himself. So I think you're right. I think that there's a lack of strong collectivity in the film, but the docs were in the front page of the news every single day when this movie came out. Everybody would have understood the context for the film, and I think that's one of the things we've lost. Nobody remembers that there was basically a wildcat strike every year on the docks from like 47 to 57. You know, we've just lost that sense of the period, of how many strikes there were. I mean, everybody watching the Honeymooners in New York knew that they couldn't get a bus because the TWU was on strike. You know, that was known because it was experienced. And there were more than 3,000 strikes in the 1950s. The garment workers go on strike in 1958. It's their first general strike in 25 years. It's a strike of almost 500,000 people. All these strikes have just been lost to history. And I'm maybe going about this a little bit backwards, but I'm using these stories to focus on them. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, but progressive labor historians just won't touch the 50s. They won't touch it. They think Dubinsky, you know, was an anti-communist sellout. They think Meany was a sellout. You know, progressive labor historians will not give credit to unions in the 50s. They won't. They're not honored.
Other questions or comments?
Do you have some of the records of the studios discussing these sorts of films, right? And some of the joke. To what degree did they understand these things as like profit centers? It's not in the sense of them pandering to an audience, but it's the second part of this question is, when does the enthusiasm for this kind of representation end here in Hollywood?
I mean, I think I could write a book like this about every decade, yeah. But I mean, Marty was an accident. It was a very popular television show. Harold Hecht and Burt Lancaster decided to make it into a film. They were going to make it as a tax write-off. Totally bombed initially. They decided to roll it out in a different way. And they kept it at, there was only in one theater in New York, so at the Sutton Theater. They kept it there for 4 months, but they didn't let it be in any other theater. So they said people flocked from the suburbs to come to this one theater. It didn't play as well in the Heartland. But then the studios were excited because it was so cheap to make, and they made so much money from it. They kept trying to reproduce the Marty Miracle over and over and over again. Because, of course, the hidden story here is that television is coming in, is taking that audience away. So this was an attempt to get some of those working class people who were watching TV instead of going to the movies. So some films you've probably never heard of. A Catered Affair is an Ernest Borgnine film made from a Paddy Chayefsky TV script where he's a taxi driver who doesn't want to pay for an expensive wedding for his daughter. With Betty Davis. A film called The Rabbit Trap, another Borgnine TV script that tries to become a film. None of these films worked. I mean, Hollywood is desperate. They'll do anything to try and get people to come and see a movie. Even make a black and white pro-working class film. Because they don't know what's going to work. It really, until the blockbuster era, they don't figure it out. They can't. In 1946, 90 million people a week went to the movies. I think by this time it's like 40, by 54. So they lose. They lose half of all Americans who went to movies, to TV. And so they'll try anything to get people back into theaters.
Jim?
I'd like to take one more tug at the very loose and interesting string that dangles from the Southern that we made for us. I don't think that final scene is any more or maybe any less fascist than the everyday lives that millions of Americans are trying to lead now. I am struck again and again and again, and most often unexpectedly, I don't go out looking for this, by the fantastic struggle that people are having. Make it from morning to night in this country.
Absolutely.
There's different ways that this is happening.
Yeah.
But it's happening all around us. And it's there.
A friend of mine
get up with, you know, with blood streaming directly to the face.
Or chocolate syrup in this case.
Our hearts are in breathing.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I think this is one of the worst times for American workers in American history. And a friend of mine, Corey Robin, blogs about all the things you can get fired for. You know, it's just extraordinary what American workers can be fired for tweeting, for, you know, posting something on Facebook, for not agreeing to give a liver to a boss who needs a liver transplant. Yeah, I think these are really dark times, and that's why I see the 50s when there were 35% of all Americans were in unions. Unions were part of the normal fabric of American life, and I'm trying to represent the sort of images of that period that have been papered over by that suburban imagery. That's right.
And the union movement was at the foundation.
Yeah, absolutely. We had the least income disparity in this country from the beginning of the country to now in 1958.
Oh, and those Rachel Maddow would also love the actual tax rate on millionaires.
Exactly. Exactly.
And Eisenhower yeah. still kept any tax cuts.
Yeah.
Other questions or comments? Well, let us give Kathleen.
Thank you guys so much for your attention. That's right. Thank you so much.